DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, history made as the EU's asylum and migration pact is passed. Nicaragua drags Germany before the International Court of Justice.
Germany is now in a complicated place of wondering, should this be the point at which, for the first time, the scale of the civilian killings happening now in Gaza means that we as Germany, given that we always feel that we have an important voice to speak up on human rights because of our own history, should we actually be speaking up for the Palestinians?
And Slovakia's Robert Fico gets the president he wanted. All that plus a sporting summit and a foretaste of Olympic tensions. History made. We have delivered a robust legislative framework on how to deal with migration and asylum in the EU. That was how Roberta Metsola, the European Parliament President, announced the passing of the EU's Pact on Asylum and Migration to the world on Twitter or X on Wednesday. But plenty of people are dissatisfied, some saying the package will lead to greater human suffering at Europe's borders, and others saying that it doesn't go far enough to protect them. Terry Schultz has this summary for us.
The European Union's new Migration and Asylum Pact contains 10 different parts, some of them more controversial than others. It will make it harder for people to come to Europe and stay in Europe if they don't have a valid reason to seek asylum, such as fear of persecution in their homelands. People will have their claims processed faster, according to the new laws, and they'll be deported faster if it's determined they're just seeking better living conditions. It aims to better share the responsibility, which currently is disproportionately borne by those countries along Europe's southern edge, for example, in Greece, Italy, and Spain, by compelling other countries to either take in some of these people or pay to take care of them elsewhere. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who's in charge of the executive branch that formally proposed the legislation in 2020, was extremely relieved.
Today is indeed a historic day. After years of intense work, the Pact of Migration and Asylum becomes a reality. It is a huge achievement for Europe. We all understand this fundamental truth. Migration is a European challenge which must be met with a European solution, one that is effective and both fair and firm. And this is what the Pact on Migration and Asylum delivers.
Some of these reforms have been in the works almost a decade, since the high mark of asylum attempts in 2015, when 1.3 million people arrived in Europe. European Parliament President Roberta Metsola portrays the package as a win for all sides.
That provides for a robust legislative framework that is the same in all member states, that puts humanity first, that understands all the different, difficult aspects of this issue, that secures Europe's external borders, that provides clarity on applicable rules, that ensures the right balance between solidarity and responsibility in full respect of fundamental rights.
But right up to the last minute, it was unclear whether it would pass or not because some measures are so controversial. Lawmakers on the far right and far left opposed it as either too soft or too harsh. Human rights activists staged a protest inside the public area of the parliament, shouting at lawmakers to vote against it. Organizations such as Amnesty International and Oxfam say people who need protection will be kept out by stricter border management. But with European Union elections looming in June and many politicians wanting to prove they've done something about this divisive issue, which typically benefits the far right, the final approval needed from all 27 EU governments is expected to be quick. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
For more detailed analysis of what this long-awaited piece of legislation means, check out our webpages at dw.com.
Our history is the reason why Israel's security has been at the core of German foreign policy.
That was Germany's lawyer, Tanja von Usler-Gleichen, addressing the International Court of Justice in The Hague on Tuesday, urging it to reject Nicaragua's case accusing Germany of breaching the UN Genocide Convention by sending military hardware to Israel and ceasing funding of the UN's aid agency in Palestine. With over 30,000 dead and famine looming in Gaza, this is a case with indisputable urgency in the present. As the lawyer indicated, however, it is also a case fraught with symbolic significance due to Germany's responsibility for the historic crimes out of which the very concept of genocide originated. To understand more about the implications of the case, I spoke to Steve Crawshaw, former UK director at Human Rights Watch and author of the upcoming book Prosecuting the Powerful on War Crimes and the Struggles for International Justice.
Sure. So as you say, there are levels of deep and cruel ironies that are built into this. We need to start perhaps by just mentioning briefly that Nicaragua, that is bringing this case, to say that it's not Lily White is the understatement of the world. I mean, Nicaragua has an appalling human rights record itself. So that this is not the human rights hero which is bringing this case in the first place. But as regards where we are, you're right that there are these different levels of irony. The very word genocide, as you mentioned, was created in connection with the Holocaust by a Polish Jewish lawyer who came up with the word, published it in 1944, and the Genocide Convention, again through his work, happened in 1948. We had Nuremberg, which still remains as a kind of foundation stone of what justice means and war crimes justice means. It was heavily criticized also as victor's justice, but it was a starting point which many other things have grown on in the meantime, including the International Criminal Court, which deals with individual criminal cases, as opposed to the intergovernmental cases which the International Court of Justice is dealing with. So at the time, in 1945, to be honest, Germany was not, and especially in the years after that, Germany or most Germans were uninfused by what they saw as a stitch-up, if you like. They saw it purely as victor's justice, and they thought it was very unfair on Germany. That changed radically over the years, that Germany has become, in the decades since the Second World War, one of the most important champions of global justice, a very important champion for the International Criminal Court, and very much standing up with its own history in mind, very much standing up for the importance of justice. Which brings us to where we are today, which is this odd contradiction which Nicaragua is exploiting, cynically one might say, but nonetheless something there to exploit, is that Germany's commitment to international justice goes, for the same historical reasons, along with a very deep desire to support Israel wherever possible, or as some German leaders would say, always, not even having the caveat of wherever possible. So the previous Chancellor Angela Merkel used the phrase Staatsraison, that this is Israel is Germany's raison d'etat, as it were. The current Social Democrat Chancellor really supports that as well, has said some very, very strong things in support of Israel after the brutal attacks, the Hamas attacks, which killed more than 1,200 on 7th of October, but also after the strong Israel assault had begun. And that's where it got difficult a bit, because the reluctance to criticize Israel, with now more than 30,000 civilians dead, not only Germany doing that, to be fair, but Germany was particularly vulnerable in that. It was particularly odd when we saw, for example, Jewish voices we've seen in Germany. So you've had German Jewish people criticizing and then themselves being slapped down for criticizing Germany for its failure to criticize Israel. So it's a very complicated set of Russian dolls, if you like, of the different layers on that. So Germany is now in a complicated place, never mind the court case, but it's in a complicated place of wondering, should this be the point at which, for the first time, the scale of the civilian killings happening now in Gaza means that we as Germany, given that we always feel that we have an important voice to speak up on human rights because of our own history, should we actually be speaking up for the Palestinians? That's obviously a very uncomfortable place, massively exploited in Israeli government narratives. So that's where we are. And the court case this week, and a previous court case, which still ongoing, which South Africa brought, which is alleging genocide, both of those bring a particular resonance to everything that's happening now.
One thing that this case and the South African case have in common is that whatever the motivations of Nicaragua, they are both attempts to make an impact in a situation which is ongoing. Do you think it stands a chance of working, of having an impact?
I think it's already having significant political impact. The International Court of Justice used to be a court which, unless you were deeply, deeply buried in judicial matters, you probably hadn't even heard of. And if you had heard of it, you probably got it confused with the International Criminal Court. What we've seen with those two cases, the South Africa case and the Nicaragua case, we've had important cases from the International Court of Justice before, but none of them have had quite the same resonance. This has real resonance because the Security Council is never going to address this, frankly. So the American veto, not just the American veto, but importantly, the US veto of the Security Council, means that criticism, sharp criticism, there's been some small criticism, sharp criticism of Israel has traditionally been almost unthinkable. That deadlock at the Security Council has been taken for granted for so long. People have shrugged their shoulders. People may have regretted it, but there seemed no way to challenge it. But this, if you like, is a side door of creating political pressure. And you see it dramatically on the International Criminal Court. So I think these two courts in The Hague, both just a few kilometers from each other, are the cases are very linked in a way in that they both have impact on political discourse. And we see that the fact that the International Criminal Court got involved a couple of years ago, even before 7th of October, it theoretically got involved, but it didn't seem to have any impact. Now, in recent months, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has been a couple of times to Israel and to the West Bank, and seems, Palestinians are still very skeptical, but seems to be taking it seriously. He's appointed a senior British military prosecutor for that work. That ICC case, that case from the International Criminal Court, a couple of years ago, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, in speaking to his cabinet, listing the most important strategic issues on Israel's plate, listed Iran, listed COVID, this was during the COVID pandemic, and third, listed the fact that the International Criminal Court was interested. He said, this is one of our strategic challenges. The fact that the Israeli Prime Minister is so worried is, of course, a clear backhanded compliment to the court itself and to its power. And the same thing applies with the International Court of Justice, that whereas the Security Council is a place where nothing really happens, the headlines coming out of these two Hague cases, and indeed a third Hague case, which was more in the shadows before, which is to do with legality of Israeli policy, all of those three interlinked cases are meaning that politicians around the world who do not wish to have a stand-up fight with the International Court of Justice, which is the UN court, the world court, but they're also uncomfortable about criticising Israel, they're having to make some very, very difficult choices.
Well, Steve Crawshaw, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much indeed.
Steve Crawshaw is former UK director at Human Rights Watch and author of the upcoming book, Prosecuting the Powerful. We'll be posting a link to a longer version of that interview in our show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Slovakia has a new president. Peter Pellegrini, an ally of the country's populist Prime Minister Robert Fico, defeated veteran pro-Western diplomat Ivan Korchok, claiming over 53% of the vote. Mr. Pellegrini won the election by echoing a lot of Mr. Fico's Moscow-friendly rhetoric on Ukraine. But will that continue once he's inaugurated as president? Rob Cameron has more from Prague in the neighbouring Czech Republic.
Peter Pellegrini has reached the pinnacle of his two decades in Slovak politics. From a lowly advisor to an MP in Mr. Fico's Smer party, then an MP himself, then education minister, a brief spell as prime minister when Mr. Fico was forced to resign, then parliament chairman, and now president. Mr. Pellegrini said he would not stand in the way of the Fico government in domestic affairs unless it veered from its policy program or acted against the constitution. It was, in effect, a pledge of fealty to his coalition ally Robert Fico, standing by his side.
The government of the Slovak Republic can be assured that it will not have to worry that the presidential palace, as has been the case for the last 10 years, will become the centre of the opposition or opportunistic power that will harm the government, that will harm the state abroad, and will rejoice in the failures of the Slovak government.
This was taken as an indication he will give Fico free rein to continue his assault on Slovakia's institutions. He's already ripped up the country's penal code, abolishing the special prosecutor's office. Now, Slovakia's public broadcaster and perhaps NGOs could be next in the firing line. But it was President-elect Pellegrini's comments on foreign policy, especially the war in Ukraine, that drew thunderous applause.
I will do everything possible, whether people like it or not, to ensure that Slovakia always remains on the side of peace and not on the side of war. And people can criticise me for it all they want.
So where will he stand when it comes to Slovakia's relations with Washington and Brussels? What about Russia? What about Ukraine? In subsequent interviews, he reiterated his opposition to sending weapons to Kyiv, saying 2 years of fighting had achieved nothing and it was time for Ukraine to seek peace talks. However, Mr. Pellegrini, who won the election partly by claiming he would never, unlike his opponent, send Slovak boys off to fight in Ukraine, said he regarded Russia as the clear aggressor in the conflict and said Slovakia would never recognise territory seized by force. He also insisted his election was a guarantee of Slovakia's place in the EU and NATO. Alena Kutsko, an analyst for the leading Bratislava think tank Globsec, said Mr. Pellegrini is likely to perform a delicate balancing act.
My perception from the campaign and from the situation right now, that first and foremost, Pellegrini is pro-Pellegrini. And he's looking for allies based on the situation, based on what can benefit him more at the current moment in time. Importantly, he does not see Russia or Robert Fico's government or Orban's government as a no-go. He does think that something can be gained from alliance with them based on the particular issue in question, based on the situation. But he equally says that there's a lot that can be gained from alliances in Brussels, in the United States or elsewhere. So I think he will try to balance all possible alliances, maybe sit not on two chairs, but on as many chairs as possible for as long as possible to maintain the support that he needs, and it will be very situational.
The international headlines honed in around Mr. Pellegrini's pledge to be a president not of war, but of peace, and most described him as pro-Russian, a populist, and so on. He may be those things, but for now, despite winning his country's highest office, the newly elected president is still emerging from the shadows of his boss, Robert Fico. For DW, this is Rob Cameron, in Prague.
The sands of European politics are shifting. To stay up to date with the latest developments, you can, of course, make sure that you're subscribed to Inside Europe wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, sport. After an absence of 5 years, largely due to COVID, one of the most important sporting summits has just taken place. The Sport Accord Business Summit was hosted by the English city of Birmingham. It brought together international federations from around the world, including all those whose sports will feature in the Paris Olympics. And not surprisingly, given the proximity of those games, the Olympics featured high on the agenda, as Inside Europe's Ashish Sharma reports.
But once business got underway, two themes were clearly emerging as the Paris Olympics loom large on the horizon. One is the issue of safety and security. The games are fast approaching, while conflict rages in Gaza between Israel and Hamas, and the ongoing war in Ukraine following Russia's invasion. And linked closely to the second is the other issue, that of the participation of athletes from Russia, Belarus, and of course, Ukraine itself. Well, I'm standing here outside the International Convention Centre, which is hosting the Sports Summit. It's a pretty grim and, I have to say, rainy Birmingham. But inside the venue itself, there is a lot of excitement. So one of the key presentations at the summit was made by the organising committee of the Paris Games.
End of 2015, beginning of 2016, just after the massive attacks we had in France. The authorities decided to defend what it is important in France, and the fact that it's not because we have been attacked that we should stop with gathering people, defending liberty and values important for France.
Tony Estanguet is the president of Paris 2024 and championed the notion of holding an opening ceremony outside a stadium for the first time ever. The idea is to make the Olympics more inclusive to all, but it also poses one of the biggest security risks.
Security is definitely part of the mix of the decisions till the beginning, and every decision we made to organize those games into the city for, again, La Place de la Concorde, for all the urban sports, or the archery and Les Invalides, beach volleyball at the foot of the Eiffel Tower, and even the opening ceremony, were taken with this in mind, that we are in a very situation of security, and that there will be no risk at all for the athletes or for the spectators. And the public authorities, they put in place an unprecedented security system in place. We will have a perimeter of security very large many days before the opening ceremony to completely secure the zone.
Another talking point has been the inclusion of athletes from Russia and Belarus, which supports the war in Ukraine. The International Olympic Committee that owns the Games has only allowed individual athletes from these nations to take part, provided, of course, they qualify. Their status is that of individual neutral athletes. It means they can't wear their country's colours, have their flag or national anthem sung if they get on the podium. It has been controversial, and some federations, such as World Athletics, has banned them from taking part in their events. But Francesco Ricciabitti from the Organising Commission of the Olympic Games says preventing athletes from taking part goes against the values of the Olympics.
Generally speaking, the athletes should be not punished for action of their own government. This is not easy. It's easy to say, it's a little bit less easy to achieve and to implement. We also always said that sport should be a bridge, never a wall, because there is the only language, universal language of sport, as to help. I always said I'm not in favor of what has happened, but we need to prepare a better situation, a better condition. One day this conflictual situation will stop and we have to be ready. We cannot cut all the links with everybody.
Well, I think Paris has a lot of iconic venues for many of our sports, so that's great. Of course, I'm particularly happy to be in Versailles. It's a wonderful backdrop. It reminds me also a little bit the London Games in Greenwich with the Queen's House in the background. We are very happy to go to Paris. There always will be things that need to be addressed. We are flexible organizations. We want to contribute to this success, and I think it has all the potential to be very successful games.
Well, that's Ingmar DeVos, the president of the International Equestrian Federation. And for all the talk of security, geopolitics and neutral athletes, in the end, the hope is that the sporting drama of the Olympic Games is what everyone will talk about. Ashish Sharma, DW, Birmingham.
Yeah, I'd say that there's as much chance of a politics-free Olympics as there is a politics-free Eurovision, to be honest. But nevertheless, good luck with that one, Ashish. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. The next half hour is a mix of my two favourite things, politics and books. The politics part first. We'll be hearing about two unexpected bids for power shaking things up in Hungary.
They were marching towards the parliament building, and it was really interesting to see because it was organized by a former insider of the ruling Fidesz party. His name is Peter Magyar, and he is now aiming to challenge the position of Viktor Orban.
And in Croatia.
A lot of us were a little bit surprised by this. We've been familiar with Zoran Milanovic as the Social Democrat Prime Minister, centre-left, and an educated man, multilingual, pro-European. And to hear the sort of things that he's been coming out with, not just the standpoints that he's been taking, but the way in which he's been expressing them, you know, in the language of the barroom.
Then to the books, lots of them, as we bring you the pick of the Bologna Children's Book Fair.
What is most important is to have a concrete story, a story that grabs you and inspires you, and that's what we're looking for.
Time to settle down and get stuck in.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Hungary's strongman Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his ruling Fidesz party have had a continuous grip on power for 14 years now. In recent weeks, however, the homogeneity of Hungarian politics has been severely shaken. First, by a paedophile pardoning scandal which toppled both the president and the justice minister, and now by this. That's the sound of tens of thousands of protesters who took to the streets of Budapest last weekend in anti-government demonstrations organised by Peter Magyar, a lawyer, former diplomat and Fidesz insider who used to be married to the same Minister of Justice who was forced to resign back in February. Magyar is now positioning himself as a centrist opposition leader, but does he have the political credibility to become a serious threat to Viktor Orban? Well, our Budapest correspondent Stefan Voss was at those protests last week, the first, he believes, of many, and feels that something significant has indeed shifted.
Yes, indeed. It was really amazing. I would say it is the largest demonstration I have seen personally in years. I would say at least some 100,000 Hungarians, many waving flags, were rallying. They were marching towards the parliament building. And it was really interesting to see because it was organized by a former insider of the ruling Fidesz party. His name is Peter Magyar. Now, it is perhaps good to know that he publicly broke with the government already in February, and he is now aiming to challenge the position of Viktor Orban, the longtime powerful prime minister who has been in charge, I would say, for the last 14 years. So, in other words, there is a generation that grew up with no other leader than Orban in charge.
Right, so many questions there. I just want to zoom in on the flags. You mentioned there was flag waving. Are we talking about Hungarian flags here?
Yes, we are talking about Hungarian flags. And I think it was really an attempt to show that you don't have to be a Orban fan to be a Hungarian patriot. And I think that is the message I also could hear from demonstrators, that they say, we want to participate in a movement that is pro-Western, pro-European Union, but at the same time, we don't want to forget that we are still Hungarians, and of course we remain also proud at our nation. I mean, Hungary has been struggling also for freedom in recent decades. There is, of course, the 1956 uprising against invading Soviet forces and so on. So there were definitely different times in history where Hungarians feel, you know, that was also part of our nation, and we don't want that heritage to be hijacked by the current Prime Minister Viktor Orban. So I think those flags also express sentiments that there are Hungarians who are still proud to be Hungarian, but they are not anti-Western or only pro-Russian, as the Prime Minister Viktor Orban has been accused of.
So that's really interesting. So we've got an attempt there to sort of repackage the potential meaning of what it means to be Hungarian. This is presumably part of Magyar's bid to appeal to the base that he thinks he's got to activate in order to become a credible leader of this new opposition movement. How credible do you think he is as a political figure?
Well, I think one of the things, of course, the government is using are his alleged personal flaws. This has been played out very publicly. He has been accused of domestic violence against the former justice minister. But he says, Peter Magyar maintains, that his wife has been put under pressure and that he will basically always be there for her and the children. Now, normally, of course, one would say this is a private affair, let them have a therapy and work it out together. But because it was played out so publicly, these personal flaws may haunt him in the near future. So people will, I think, have a wait-and-see attitude how this will play out and whether he will form a challenge towards the Hungarian Prime Minister.
And of course, the European elections upcoming in June will be the first big test of that. What platform can we expect him to be standing on?
Well, he will definitely stand on a platform of a centre party, I would say. He wants to unite both the leftist Hungarians and the more right-wing and conservative Hungarians, definitely not the extremists. I mean, he doesn't want to have anything to do with them, but you know, most of the people, I would say, they are really divided between left and right, and that is quite a challenge, because I would say Hungarian society is very much polarized. You can even feel it when you speak with people on the streets, and I also know from personal experience among friends that some of them even are afraid to be involved in all kind of even in journalism projects, you know, which I wanted to develop with them, because they say, you know, we may lose contracts with the government, or and I know other people even in the crowds who told me that their family may be upset, or they may even have problems at work. So there is this fear also even among Hungarians to speak out, I would say, against the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. And it also really leads to divisions within families. I mean, there are people who for instance, don't speak with each other anymore. And that sort of things are really happening. Now, beneath it all, critics say, is also the Hungarian government propaganda through the media they still control, especially, I would say, outside Budapest, the Hungarian capital being a more liberal, I would say, part of Hungary, but outside you still have difficulties reaching people, although it is very interesting to me to see that people from far away also came to the protest. So it's definitely a development to watch.
Mm. Well, Stefan, a very interesting time to be our Budapest correspondent. Thank you so much for joining me on what...
That's an understatement.
I don't think this will be the last update.
Yes, no, it will not be the last update, I'm afraid. No, there's more to come.
Our Budapest correspondent, Stefan Voss there. Peter Magyar is not the only colourful figure making an unexpected pitch for the centre ground in Europe at the moment. Croatia goes to the polls in parliamentary elections next Wednesday, and a certain Zoran Milanovic will be running for Prime Minister. The problem? He happens to already be the sitting president. Now, the constitutional basis for this move may be wobbly, to say the least, but the head of state's intervention has certainly enlivened what might otherwise have been a predictable election. A situation which I can't help but suspect that our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, may secretly be rather relishing.
Well, when we get back down to sort of like the bottom line of this thing, Kate, what we've got are two major parties in Croatia. You've got the opposition, the centre-left Social Democrats, and the governing party, the centre-right to right-wing nationalist HDZ. And since Croatia's independence in 1991, the HDZ has dominated. I mean, if you look at Croatia at any given point, about 8 times out of 10, they would have a government led by the HDZ. We did, however, have a Social Democrat government between 2011 and 2016, and that was led by Zoran Milanovic, who was Prime Minister then. He's President now, and he's been President since 2020. Now, in Croatia, the President is supposedly, though I have to say not always, a non-party political role. In other words, you're not meant to take political stances on things, or at least party political stances on things. But in fact, Mr. Milanovic has used the position to launch attack after attack on Prime Minister Andrej Plenković and the HDZ. And that, rather unexpectedly, in a move which shocked the nation, I have to tell you, Kate, culminated him in declaring that he would be a candidate for Prime Minister in the elections for the Social Democrats.
Well, shocked the nation and shocked the courts as well, Guy, because there are legal obstacles here as well, aren't there?
Absolutely there are. And the big question was whether the president could run in a parliamentary election without first resigning as head of state. Now, you know, there were some questions about this, because if you look at the constitution, it does say that, well, there's nothing to stop him from running in a European election, for example. So the president could run to become a member of the European Parliament. But the constitution did seem to be fairly clear that the president couldn't run for Croatia's parliament. And the judges at the constitutional court duly made that ruling to a furious reaction from Mr. Milanovic.
I suggest to the people who have supported me, namely the parties led by the SDP, to be cunning and cautious, to watch what they do, because that gangster clique has taken the court hostage. Such peasants are also illiterate, therefore it's a problem, because the decision is illiterate. A literate person, at least one who has completed driving school, would have problems with this decision, with what's written there.
Wow, some really quite striking rhetoric there. Is this a regular feature of Mr. Milanovic's style, Guy?
Oh, absolutely it is. And it's been a feature of his style, really, since he became the president. A lot of us were a little bit surprised by this. We've been familiar with Zoran Milanovic as the Social Democrat Prime Minister, centre-left, and an educated man, multilingual, pro-European. And to hear the sort of things that he's been coming out with, not just the standpoints that he's been taking, but the way in which he's been expressing them, you know, in the language of the barroom, to put it politely, rather than any sort of statesmanlike language, that's been quite arresting, I would say, for an awful lot of people. And this has been continuing, despite the Constitutional Court saying that he can't go and campaign and he can't be a prime ministerial candidate for the Social Democrats. He's still, in essence, campaigning. He's out on the road every day. And the message, really, whether it's spoken out loud or not, is that a vote for the coalition led by the Social Democrats would be a vote for Zoran Milanovic as Prime Minister. You know, we'll worry about the details later. And even though the media have been advised by, you know, the legal authorities not to report his comments as part of the campaign, frankly, Mr. Milanovic is still providing all the talking points. So it's no wonder that when I ran into Prime Minister Andrej Plenković in Zagreb, he was feeling somewhat exasperated.
I think we're on the right track, and this is what we are going to explain to our citizens. It requires a lot of, as the French would say, pédagogie politique. Sometimes we are distracted with diversion and sabotages, such as the current one by the incumbent president of the republic, but that is less relevant because it's an anti-constitutional behavior. What is relevant that the Croats are provided with the government and with the parliamentary majority, which will ensure stability over the next 4 years.
So that's Andrej Plenković, who's the current prime minister, leader of the HDZ party. And Mr. Plenković always comes across as a reasonable figure, very much the centre-right voice of his party. But his party, I have to say, isn't entirely just a party of the centre-right. It's always been a Croat nationalist party, and a large part of its support base still comes from the right-wing nationalist element in Croatia. So this is why what Mr. Milanovic, the president, what he's been doing has been quite interesting. The ways in which he's been speaking out, the language he's been using, and the topics he's been talking about, it's all basically about looking to snaffle some of the HDZ's traditional support base. So when he's speaking out about immigration, Croatia's involvement in providing military support to Ukraine, the situation of ethnic Croats in Bosnia, all of the ways in which he's been talking about that have been designed to appeal, in essence, to maybe traditional HDZ voters, even if that might be rather alarming to voters who would traditionally vote for the Social Democrats. Now, I spoke to Sandra Benčić. She's the prime ministerial candidate for the Green Left Party, Možemo. They actually have control of Zagreb on a municipal basis. The mayor of Zagreb is from the Možemo party, and they're very much a rising force in Croatian politics. They're not part of the main centre-left coalition going into the election, but she says they would consider joining forces with a potential Milanovic government.
Basically, would say he's not left, he's a liberal. That's my opinion. And I think a lot of reaching out towards the right wing is actually tactics to take HDZ to those mythical places on the basis of which they, you know, create this public opinion that HDZ equals Croatia.
So finally, if we were to zoom out a bit, what would a potential Milanovic victory mean in terms of the region and indeed beyond, Guy?
A lot of people are asking what it would mean in terms of Croatia's support for Ukraine. And that's from an international perspective. Because Mr. Milanovic, while he's never praised Russia's invasion of Ukraine, like we've heard, you know, certain leaders in the region do, for example, Milorad Dodik, the leader of Republika Srpska in Bosnia, what Mr. Milanovic has done has been to play down the idea that Western countries should be supporting Ukraine with military equipment and military personnel. He's constantly been saying that it's going to be extremely difficult to dislodge Russia from Ukraine, and any further involvement by Western countries in Ukraine is very dangerous. So that's been his line all along, and it almost sounds complementary to Russia at times, the way in which he talks about that country. And it does sound quite familiar to some of the rhetoric that we hear from people like Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary. So that's a concern for people. The other concern is, which Zoran Milanovic are we going to get if the centre-left coalition wins the election? If Mr. Milanovic then resigns as president and becomes prime minister, what's Mr. Milanovic going to do? Is he going to carry on being this shoot-from-the-hip figure that we've seen since 2020 when he became president? Or are we going to see a return to the more considered Zoran Milanovic that we saw when he was prime minister between 2011 and 2016? That's certainly a concern for people. And it's a bit of a risk, the way in which he's been using this sort of barroom rhetoric, that while you may get some of the voters to whom that sort of language and behaviour and this perception that you're telling it like it is appeals, you may also repel a lot of your blocs, a lot of your political blocs, traditional voters who may be worried about the kind of rhetoric you're coming out with and might be looking for an alternative which isn't so outspoken on those sort of subjects.
Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, there. Whoever Croatia's next prime minister turns out to be, I am confident that Guy will continue to manage to bump into them in Zagreb for us. Now, grab yourself a cushion and a beverage of preference. We're settling down for some serious book action next. That's with me, Kate Claycock, here on Inside Europe. Thank you.
Once upon a time this week, the northern Italian city of Bologna hosted the 61st edition of the International Children's Book Fair, with around 1,500 exhibitors from 100 countries in attendance. While publishers, authors and illustrators showcased their books and artwork, deals were made to sell or buy the rights for translation and publication in other languages and countries, and there was even a new TV and film rights centre to encourage book-to-screen projects. There were spotlights on comic books, women in publishing, and of course the impact of AI. But one of the most important focuses this year was on sustainability and the potential for children's books to create a healthier planet. Our correspondent Danny Mitzman was keen to discover more.
Bologna's International Children's Book Fair feels like visiting a literary candy store. Thousands of fascinating publications for ages ranging from toddlers to teens, and wall upon wall of eye-catching artwork in exhibitions featuring some of today's top children's book illustrators. It's edifying, inspiring, and overwhelming all at once. So after a while, it's a sensory relief to reach a quieter area known as the Author's Café, for a discussion entitled Reading for a Healthy Planet, Inspiring Children's Books to Help Achieve a Sustainable Future.
So I'm going to start, since this panel has been inspired in part by the UN Sustainability Development Goals, maybe Irina, can you tell us...
Everybody here is talking about SDGs, the United Nations 17 Sustainable Development Goals for 2030, aimed at bringing peace, equality, and prosperity to people and the planet while tackling climate change. And all the guests here believe in the fundamental role children's books can play in achieving these goals.
Ed, so I would like to take it a little further from awareness to action.
Irina Lumelski, the head of UN Publications, tells me there's even an SDG book club, with a reading list recommending books in all six official UN languages.
Youth, in particular, are very vocal, and they like to act to try to achieve as much as we can. And the Sustainable Development Goals Book Club helping bring the children from age 6 to 12 on board. And so when they're 6, their parents read to them. When they're 12, you know, they read by themselves. They can organize their own chapters in the libraries, in bookstores, in their schools, and really discuss what they read, discuss, you know, what ideas they have, how they can implement it. And the books may not mention SDGs at all. They're just on the topics of SDGs.
Now, talking from a publisher's perspective, I think that doing children's books...
As president of the International Publishers Association, Brazilian publisher Karine Panza says working with the UN's goals is tangibly helping them to produce and promote children's books on sustainability.
Some titles were selected, pointed to this specific SDGs. And this list is being taken now by the Brazilian government, who's buying those specific lists to the libraries of Brazil.
While children's books dealing with these topics are nothing new, Irina says the quantity, style and approach has really improved.
Well, there were certain publishers that were always publishing on these topics, but we're seeing a lot more engagement. Not only UK publishers or US publishers or Canadian publishers, we see a lot more regional publishing. There's a lady from Sub-Saharan Africa that has this publishing house, and she published this fabulous book. This is exactly what we need. We need local examples. What is most important is to have a concrete story, a story that grabs you and inspires you, and that's what we're looking for.
And that you can relate to.
Yes, absolutely.
For Ines Castelbranco, an independent publisher from Barcelona specializing in sustainability, teaching responsibility through books should start at an early age. The key, she says, is to capture and embrace children's sense of wonder.
I think it's very important to start to help children to keep alive this sense of wonder, because we cannot fight for something we don't know. And so first we need to have this connection with nature, to love, to go outside, to observe the animals, the plants, what happens with the starry night in the forest. So I think we should start as publishers to invite children to go outside and to observe the world. And then we can invite them to do things, of course, to change, to fight against the climate change and all the things. But I think we should start with this sense of wonder and also to work together with illustrators, with authors, scientists, to make beautiful books.
But, she says, publishers need to practice what they preach.
Eco-published books. It's very important that the way we produce the books could be coherent with our topics, no? So print locally, use certified paper, and also with plant-based inks. All these things, we need to start to be more sustainable and in an ecological way, no? To take care of the form that you make the things and also about the message we are giving to the new generations.
There's an exhibition featuring dozens of beautiful books that tackle sustainability issues, but how do they avoid creating the kind of climate anxiety even some of us adults experience today?
Kids are very, very anxious about the climate changes because they're all touched into the fear mode, not into the awareness mode. And this is something that we need to care. We need to take care of it and not make them fear the changes that are going to happen, but they need to action so that it doesn't happen.
Irina agrees with Carini.
What is important for publishers is to educate in a positive direction and would not just create paranoia.
Which, of course, makes sense, but isn't as simple as it sounds.
Kids, in general, are very, very interested in these topics. So they ask continuously to know more.
Elisa Palazzi is a climatologist at the University of Turin and the author of two children's books about the climate crisis. I asked her how she manages to teach without traumatizing.
Highlighting the positive examples that exist, persons, countries, cities that are really doing lots of changes by showing the different several ways everyone can contribute to the environmental health, but also trying to be rigorous in the scientific sense. It is important to let children know that we know things and that there are negative aspects, but you have also to show the positive side of the coin. This is the way I try to communicate the climate change crisis in order to inspire children to be active, basically, and to feel protagonists of their story.
While Elisa says it's crucial to get the science right, she found working with a co-author helped create a style and tone that younger kids could relate to.
One of these books, for example, the first one addressed to the smallest, is a book based on basically questions posed exactly like a child will pose to say the consequences of global warming in the oceans. The question in Italian is ma se l'oceano si scalda, I pesci sudano?
So if the ocean gets warmer, will the fish sweat?
Exactly. And this is a quite funny question, and the answers are more serious, but there is like a dialogue. And the co-author is one who is very, very much able to use even some kind of humor. So they have fun when they read this book.
And of course, Elisa reminds me with a twinkle in her eye, children's books can entertain and educate parents too. Dani Mitzman for DW in Bologna.
A big shout out here to Dani Mitzman's 10-year-old daughter, Ariana. Her top children's literary tip, Nurse Matilda by Christiana Brand, which Ariana, by the way, read in Italian. Auguri, Ariana. That's it for today. This programme was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineer Michael Springer. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.